Okay, as you notice, no outline today because this is a review lecture. I'm going to be trying to sum up what we've covered so far in the course in preparation for the midterm on Monday. Do any of you have any questions about the midterm? Yeah?
Since we only have an hour to do
50 minutes, yes.
Better. Generally, how much of a span of the midterm is in terms of questions? How many terms of questions?
How many terms?
Or like, how many questions?
I don't know. Not that many. If you know the answers, you should be able to write them up within a half an hour. Less than that. Sometimes people turn it. Yeah?
So we're expected to make like a
No, I will give you a list of the big events, and you have to put them in chronological order, right? Look, I'm on your side, right? I want you to do well. The whole point of the exam is to separate the wheat from the chaff, the people that take the class seriously from those who don't. And if you have been coming to lectures and doing the reading the way you should and so on, you should not have any trouble with the exam. It's nothing to be terrified by. Any other questions? Yeah? Are the midterm and the final going to be 50-50? There are three components to the grade. The final, as you know, has two parts, and each of those three components would be weighed equally. Anything else? I mean, everything's going to be very straightforward. It's you know, no trick questions or anything like that. Yeah? There will be a series of questions. One of the questions, the very first question, will be, I will give you the main events and ask you to put those main events in chronological order. Right? The point there is not so that not to test your ability to learn what all these events are by rote, but to test your understanding of the logic there, right? It's like if you think that the Peace Without Victory speech came after America entered the war against Germany, then I know that there's something basic wrong with your understanding of that period. Similarly, if you think the Nazi-Soviet pact came after the outbreak of World War II, I know that there's something wrong there. Or if you think Pearl Harbor came before Germany invaded the Soviet Union, or even if you think the oil embargo came before the German invasion of the Soviet Union, that's a basic problem, you know, because the key to understanding of that period is that the hardening of American policy, symbolized by the oil embargo, was very much a product of the fears aroused by the German invasion of the USSR the previous month. So getting the chronology right is a way of it's a way of measuring how well you understand the basic logic there. The chronology reflects the underlying political logic. And since I don't have the time to kind of, in 50 minutes, to ask you to explain the whole logic, this is a proxy for that. It's a way of measuring your command of it. So that's going to be the first question. Then there'll be questions about, you know, really big things, you know, like the Versailles settlement. How did that limit Germany's power? What, the Locarno Treaty, the main Locarno Treaty, what did it provide? Right. The Stresemann policy. What was the essence of the Stresemann policy? What was the essence of Wilson's policy during the period of American involvement in the war and its immediate aftermath? You know, is Wilson a great champion of the peace of reconciliation, the way people say? You know, things like that. Or was he in favor of a punitive peace? You know, people should know things like this. What was the great climax of the conflict over the Treaty of Versailles and over the, especially over the reparations issue in the immediate post-World War I period. These are things you should know. All sorts of things like that. The logic of the situation created by the Schlieffen Plan. Why was it that a Russian decision to order general mobilization would lead inexorably to the outbreak of a great European war? Right? Well, the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo. Why did the oil embargo put Japan in a corner? Why did the oil embargo put the United States and Japan on a collision course? You know, you should understand these things because they were fundamental importance in terms of the material that that we've covered. You know, did Hitler view Munich as a great triumph or as a defeat? Was Hitler happy when war broke out in September 1939? Or, things like that. Because they test how well you understand the fundamental story. Okay? So there'll be, those kinds of questions. They're factual in the sense that you're not being asked to do analysis of your own, but they're the sorts of things that are really fundamental. Anyone who takes a course like this should know. But they're different from what you had been led to believe before you took this course. So you can't just say, well, I'm just going to rely on what I learned in high school, and I can hope to do well in this course, because I'm going to focus on areas where the evidence conflicts with what you've been led to believe, stuff like that. So, and then finally, there'll be questions about the readings. I'll get you in a second. I'm not going to ask you to do an analysis, but I am going to ask you to tell me in like three or four sentences what the core of an argument is. You know, not for the Sontag book, which is the background reading, but for the other things that we've read. You know, the Utley book, the Taylor book, the Kennan article, my thing about July 1914, stuff like that. If you think that A.G.P. Taylor was saying, the basic argument of the origins of the Second World War was that Hitler caused the war, it was all Hitler's fault, then obviously you have a real problem understanding these things. You haven't absorbed the fundamental message. And then, that whole technique of identifying an argument, seeing what the core of an argument is, not criticizing, not analyzing or evaluating in any way, just identifying the core of an argument. You should learn that. It's extremely important. I put attach very great importance to that. And then, I spend a whole lecture showing how you could do this with the Taylor book, but when it comes to these other things, like the Utley book, for example, which I didn't talk about in any great detail, you should apply that method and be able to draw out from what Utley says, the core of his argument, what's distinctive about his argument about American involvement in the Second World War, the whole argument about why America went to war with Japan, which is, after all, what he's promising to give you in the title to the book, Going to War with Japan. Now, you had a question there? Yeah? Oh, I answered it? Oh, great. Anything else? Okay, so don't forget to bring blue books, by the way. So today, like I said, I want to kind of review what we've covered in the course so far. And what have we been trying to do this quarter? We've been trying to get insight into the central issues that define the whole field of international relations. And above all, this whole question of what makes for war? How is war to be understood? And we're doing that not by laying out some sort of formal theoretical argument, but basically by reacting to ideas that we find around us. Ideas that you find in the general culture, ideas that are put forth in the political science literature, and so on. And what are these, notions that people have about how war is to be understood? What makes for war? Well, the main idea is that war is the product of aggression. Wars are started by an aggressor. War, you know, since aggression is a bad thing, war is to be understood kind of in moral terms. You know, evil aggressors, you know, attacking peace-loving victims. Yeah. There's that basic idea. So the whole problem of trying to figure out the origins of war boils down to figuring out who's to blame, who's responsible, who's guilty. The whole discussion of the origins of particular wars always has a heavy moral overlay, precisely because of that assumption that war is the product of aggression, a common assumption. Now, in reaction to that assumption, a lot of people said, well, no, you don't really need an aggressor to have a war. Wars are not necessarily the product of deliberate design, deliberate intent. They could come about even though nobody wants one, right? This whole notion of war could come about inadvertently. People stumble into them. They come about by accident. People take actions not fully aware of what they're doing. Right? How do you get at the issue of whether those views are correct? Well, you examine them in particular historical context with particular attention to various episodes that play a key role in supporting those arguments. First World War, this big argument associated with a German historian named Fritz Fischer. The First World War is a war of German aggression. The Germans deliberately engineered this war, right? True or false? Similarly, the whole inadvertent war argument, accidental war argument. People focus on the July crisis in 1914. The claim is that no one wanted this war, but it came about anyway because statesmen were overwhelmed by forces that were kind of welling up from within the military sphere. They were stampeded into this war. These military factors, you know, prevented a political process that should have resulted in some sort of compromise settlement from running its course. Right? And those arguments, you know, focus on specific claims about the coming of war in 1914. And as I say, this is the 100th anniversary of that, so you're going to be hearing a lot of this stuff later this year. All kinds of conferences and books and so on are going to be coming out about this. So to kind of get at that issue, you want to focus on that particular episode, right? And what was the point of the analysis in the first couple of lectures? There's a lecture on the general origins of the First World War. Well, there's a very different way of looking at these things. That war is neither a product of aggression nor an accident, you know, but the outcome of a political process that unfolds over time, over decades, really. Because it's, you know, you could start the story in 1871. A political process that has a certain logic to it. It's not, events aren't just random. There's a reason why one thing follows from another, and a lot of that logic has to do with power political considerations. Not like good guys versus bad guys, but everyone is trying to, you know, achieve certain goals. Goals which are in large measure conditioned by power political realities, and the goals themselves might be power political in nature, looking to power political advantage. Right? It's very hard to say one side is right, one side is wrong. But one can identify a certain logic to the process. For example, as the gap between Germany and the Western powers widened with the two Moroccan crises, Russia, which managed to maintain good relations, not just with her Western partners, but also with Germany, Russia's position naturally improved. It's just the way power politics works. You know, both Germany and the Western powers were bound to put a certain greater premium on good relations with Russia, since their relations with each other were so bad. Right? And this put Russia in the driver's seat. This enabled Russia to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans, meaning of the Balkan League of 1912, you know. It is not anything you have to know for the purposes of this course. But, you know, basically Russia pursued a more aggressive policy. Why? Because they're innately more aggressive? No, because their power, political position enabled them to do so. A position that had a lot to do with the course of relationships between Germany and the Western powers. Western powers are more dependent on Russia. Now that Russia had, so to speak, a German option, could play the German card, right? It's important to see that because it bears on our basic notions of how wars start. And then there was a lecture on the July crisis itself that focused on analysis of the military argument. The argument that this is an inadvertent war caused by the workings of the military system that were in place at the time. An argument that focused on the mobilization system, the system of interacting mobilizations that was in place in 1914. Right? And what was the argument there? Well, in a nutshell, you know, did such a system exist? You know, was it the case that, you know, a Russian mobilization would have led to a German mobilization, and therefore, and a German mobilization meant an attack on France, and thus at the very least, a continental war, probably even a war involving Britain? Answer there is, well, yes. And then, is that tantamount to saying that the mobilization system, the system of interacting mobilizations, where one mobilization led to another and thus to war, this was a cause of the war in itself? Answer there, no. Why no? Because something has to trigger it, right? It's like, the people who made the decision to trigger it, namely Russia, which took the main decision to order the first general mobilization on July 30th, 1914. If the Russians were aware of what they were doing, if they understood that they were triggering a war, and the people who made this decision, the kind of people at the top of the system, the czar, the foreign minister, and so on, if they made this decision freely for political reasons and not because they were caving in to all this pressure from the generals slamming their fists on the table and so on, you know, if those two things are true, then you can't blame the military system for causing the war. It was a decision made for political reasons. And so, to kind of get at this issue, we looked first at, were these people aware of what a general mobilization implied? Answer there, yes, they were. Did they do it because they were stampeded into it by all this pressure from the generals slamming their fist on the table and so on? Answer there, no, they weren't. So neither of those inadvertent war arguments really holds. Decision to go to war, therefore, has to be understood in political terms. And the inadvertent war argument, therefore, kind of collapses. And yet, that's the main case that people use to argue that a war can come even though no one wants it, that a war can come, you know, because of the workings of the military system that are in place at the time. A great war can be understood in essentially accidental terms. Right. Another variant of this argument, by the way, relates to 1914 and to the whole Utley claim about mid-level bureaucrats like Dean Acheson, Assistant Secretary of State, hijacking policy. You know, that the political leadership, President Roosevelt, Secretary of State Hall, they didn't even know what was going on until it was too late to do anything about it. We went to war with Japan, even though no one wanted to, because of the workings of an essentially bureaucratic system. It's a bureaucratic politics interpretation of the coming of the war. Right? You know, you focus in on these specific historical cases as a way of getting a handle on these central theoretical problems of what makes for war. Okay? Political considerations are controlling to a very large extent, or at least that's one of the main lessons to be drawn from a study of the origins of the war. Power politics, power political advantage, things like that you know, that plays a very important role in the unfolding of the story. Countries have to take those kinds of considerations into account. But there's a limit to how far you can take that sort of interpretation. And the limit is made clear when you look at the First World War itself. You know, in parapolitical terms, it was crazy to kind of continue the fighting. The first months of the war had revealed what the true military balance was, and there was approximate equality between Central Powers and the Triple Entente. And you say, well, if countries are rationally thinking about political terms and the war has revealed the true nature of the military balance, policy should adjust to that. You draw in your horns. You kind of pursue a more moderate line. Your aim should be a negotiated peace, a compromise peace, a reversion to the status quo ante, or whatever. All right? And it doesn't happen. See, in a sense, this is the real value of theory. Theory is important. In this case, realist theory, which emphasizes the importance of power politics. Theory is important, not because it gives you answers to these questions, but because it defines the problem. It brings the problems into focus. It tells you what the puzzles are. And you need a sense for what's puzzling in order to kind of do serious academic work in this area. It's like, why was there no compromise peace in the First World War when the military balance would suggest that there should have been one? And then that takes us into all these issues of domestic politics and how, you know, you gotta, you know, mobilize every last drop of energy on the part of your own population, and that means you don't want to give any hearing to defeatist talk. You want to kind of take an increasingly intransigent line in order to give your countrymen the sense that all this bloodletting is for a purpose. So you have this escalation of war aims on the part of all the belligerents. This is one of the most amazing things. You know, here you have the most absolutist regime, Tsarist Russia, you know, a semi-authoritarian, semi-democratic regime, Imperial Germany, Western democracies, the United States, the most democratic power of them all, you might think. And you find the same phenomenon, this escalation of war aims. You know, in the case of the United States, very, you know, it's just very, very striking. You know, and Kennan has that remarkable passage, I know some of you liked it, about comparing the United States to a dinosaur, you know, just, it's like, before we were involved in the war, we don't want to have any part in European affairs. No, it was just this total mess. Let them deal with their own problems. And then as soon as we come in, you know, it becomes this crusade for unlimited goals. You know, we have to fight it without stint to the absolute limit, totally crush our adversary. You know, it's like, again, this is why that contrast between the peace without victory speech and the sort of policy the United States pursued after we got in the war, so striking. Why it's so important to remember the peace without victory speech was made a few months before the U.S. declaration of war on Germany. And then right after that, you see the first of those Wilson speeches in December of 1917 I gave you in the course back. It's like, you know, Germany is evil. We have to crush evil. We, you know, talk of compromise, talk of negotiations, you know, that's unpatriotic, that's immoral. Because when you're dealing with evil, you have to, you know, fight it to the bitter end. Germany absolutely had to be crushed. You know, a punitive concept because you view the war as a crime. And why is that important? Not only does it explain why the war was fought the way it was, with Germany basically throwing in the towel, but it also explains why the United States pursued the policy it did in the immediate post-war period. So the whole notion of Wilson as the great champion of a peace of reconciliation with Germany, it just doesn't stand up when you look at the evidence. You know, over and over again, he made it clear that he considered the war a crime and that therefore Germany had to be punished. Germany had to be punished for a whole generation. while Germany made amends for her crime in causing the war, and in that way worked her way back into the community of civilized nations. Right? A very punitive philosophy. You can't understand the Treaty of Versailles without taking that into account. Wilson took it for granted. Germany had caused the war. You believe in the rule of law? Well, the rule of law would be a farce if you didn't punish the lawbreaker. Right? What, how could you have a law without the lawbreaker being punished? Right? And so I gave a couple of lectures there about the making of the Versailles Peace. And like I say, you should understand the basic elements of the Versailles system, that this is a set of constraints on German power. Germany was not given equal rights with the victor powers. Germany was to be kept down, prevented from building a big military establishment, the sort of military establishment that had resources, if Germany had been free to use them as she shows fit, would have allowed Germany to achieve a position in continental Europe that was more impressive than the position that Germany had even in 1914. No counterweight to Germany in the East anymore. In fact, Germany is shielded from any possible Russian threat by this wall of hostile East European states tied to the West. Germany is much stronger than France. France bled white by the war, stagnant population, German population continuing to grow. German economy much stronger than that of France. Right? What's the solution from the standpoint of France? Well, ideally, you would want a continuation of the wartime alliance with Britain and America. But Britain and America don't want to have anything to do with that kind of idea, certainly the Americans. I mean, here you have this Versailles Peace, very much in line with Wilson's philosophy at that point, and it's bound to provoke German resistance because it's based on the whole idea that the Germans are responsible for the war, and yet the whole question of, well, how do you deal with German resistance? The reaction to that on the part of people like Wilson and his followers was, you can't use force. It's immoral to use force, except in time of war. Force is not a normal and natural and legitimate element in international political life. They're forced to choose. Do you want to enforce this treaty, or do you want to basically change it? And their views about what had caused the war change, and their commitment to the enforcement of the treaty vanishes practically overnight. And what this does is put a whole lot of pressure on the French not to enforce the treaty. And all of these changes, the Germans sense, they sense that there's very little power behind the treaty settlement. It's not the harshness of Versailles which is the source of instability, right? Because the post-1945 settlement was much harsher on Germany and yet proved to be much more stable. The post-1919 settlement was unstable because it provoked German resistance and also kind of gave them more of a green light to resist because there was so little power on the side of the enforcement of it. Britain and America kind of turned against it very quickly, and that put a lot of pressure on France to not enforce the treaty. Germans sensed all this stuff. They had a policy of resistance. So there's this big struggle over the treaty. Germans sensed that the way is clear toward the destruction of Versailles. Buildup of German power, Versailles constraints, the disarmament, the demilitarization of the Rhineland. The crisis comes to a head in 1923. Germans encouraged to resist, French reluctant to either enforce the treaty for fear of alienating Britain and America, or to simply junk the treaty and abandon any attempt to preserve the fruits of victory. finally, the struggle kind of comes to a head in the Ruhr Crisis of 1923, the climax of the Great Dispute over Reparations, which is really the great dispute over whether Versailles would remain intact. The French, they lose in the final analysis. This does not mean that Germans have it's all free and clear for the Germans to now build up their power. They proceed in a more indirect way. This is the essence of the Stresemann policy of the late 1920s. Not headlong resistance, an attempt to overthrow the treaty, but an attempt to finesse things, to gradually chip away at the Versailles system, gradually remove the constraints on German power, the shackles of Versailles, the Germans call them. Okay? Remove the constraints on German power, build up German power. And then when German power is built up, the Germans could talk in a tougher voice, a stronger voice, and insist on changes in the status quo. You know, what are those changes in the status quo? Territorial changes. Getting back, certainly, the territories that she lost to Poland at the end of the war, the so-called Polish Corridor, this whole area over here, and Upper Silesia over there. Two-thirds of which was given to Poland in 1921 after a plebiscite. Not stopping there, they also wanted the German-speaking areas of the former Austrian Empire. The new rump state of German Austria would be annexed. The kind of fringe areas of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland it was called. You know, basically what would this do? It would make Germany pretty much of a hegemon on the continent of Europe. Germany overwhelmed France, you know, both in manpower and even more in terms of industrial potential, let's say war-making potential. If she were free to rearm, you know, France would be forced to live in the shadow of German power. No counterweight to Germany in the East. You know, the other democratic powers, Britain and America, not willing to come to the support of France until maybe it's too late. You know, this is what Germany is reaching for, but gradually, slowly, in a way that wouldn't lead to a war. Okay? Why is this story important? Because it shows that there's a fundamental political problem that had not been resolved by the Locarno settlement. Germany had not been reconciled to the status quo. Germany has rather far-reaching goals, goals which it might be a little hard for the Western powers, or at least especially for France, to accept. Okay, people like to think that, oh, well, this was peace was being put on a stable basis. Democratic countries like Weimar Germany and Democratic France, they don't go to war with each other. They don't really have security problems with each other. You know, if it weren't for the Depression, and especially if it weren't for Hitler, you know, if the 1920s had stayed as they were, there wouldn't have been any problems. What's the proof that's not the case? Well, one very clear proof was the French decision to build a line of fortifications across northern France to deal with a possible resurgent German threat. When is that decision made? 1929, before the Depression strikes, well before Hitler comes to power in Germany. That shows the continuation of a political problem. Very important point, because it shows that our kind of common views about the origins of the war, it's all Hitler, it's because of the Nazis. If a democratic regime had remained intact, everything would have been all, you know, sweetness and light. Not true. There's a political problem that remains constant. There's a greater degree of continuity between the 20s and the 30s than we've been led to believe. Right? Which is not to say that the whole Nazi phenomenon counted for nothing and it didn't matter at all that Hitler was in power. Of course it did. It's the most obvious thing in the world that it mattered. Just not quite as much as some people used to say, because even Hitler had to be concerned with power political realities. You know, the importance of power politics is what establishes this continuity between the 20s and the 30s. Right? What's Hitler's policy in the early period? Very cautious, testing the waters, not full speed ahead. You know, all these measures that were adopted to kind of steer Germany through what the German leaders themselves viewed as a danger zone. You know, but by 1936, the Germans felt like the risks were fairly low and were prepared to move ahead. Key event there, the remilitarization of the Rhineland in March of 1936, meaning that Germany can now move more rapidly toward building up her power and toward, in fact, using her power to change the status quo in the East. Did Hitler, from the start, want a war with Britain and France? Certainly not. He wanted a free hand in the East. He wanted the Western powers to just sit on their hands and allow him to do what he wanted in the East. He thought he can get the British, certainly, to kind of give him what he wanted. And to his amazement, it became clear that while the British were willing to accept certain important changes in the status quo to Germany's advantage, the whole notion of a free hand in the East, that was too much. Why was it too much? Because Germany would become so powerful if she were allowed to kind of create a huge empire in Europe, largely at the expense of Soviet Russia. So powerful that that would be essentially the end even of British independence. Britain couldn't stand up to that sort of German colossus. So you could see which way things were going. You had to put a limit to it, right? But where exactly should that line be drawn? Right? Hitler comes to the conclusion that sooner or later there's going to be a war with what he called these hate-inspired adversaries. The very term suggests his view that British and French policy was irrational. You know, why should they resist him when he's strong when they didn't resist him when he was weak? Yeah. Irrational. We have to look forward to a war with them, but not right away. We first have to build up our power to the point where we can win that war. And what's the date that he has in mind? 1943 to 1945. That's the period that he refers to as the period when there will be this military showdown with the Western powers. To prepare for that, Germany has to kind of clear the decks and in effect, strengthen herself, acquire more resources, and remove these enemies to her east. These East European states that had ties with the West, military alliances with France, and so on. Czechoslovakia and Poland. And so you find its quickening of German policy in 1938, the policy that leads to the annexation of Austria, the Anschluss of Austria, as it was called, in March of 38. Austria isolated, German-speaking area, big Nazi movement. It's not like Hitler had a specific timetable. He was prompted to act more quickly than he had wanted to by moves that the Austrians were making that forced Hitler's hand. But the annexation of Austria, changes the strategic situation. And now Czechoslovakia, the Bohemian heartland of Czechoslovakia, is surrounded on three sides. And later in 1938, you have the Czech crisis. Okay. And what's striking here? That this is this great triumph for Hitler, that he viewed Munich as this big triumph? No, one of the big insights to emerge from historical research is that he viewed Munich as a defeat. In fact, he backed down from the demands that he made at Godesberg. He backed down because Chamberlain wanted to kind of accede, was forced to resist by essentially a revolt within the British cabinet. Lord Halifax, the foreign secretary, was the key figure there, right? And Hitler paid a certain domestic political price within the German establishment for having backed down. This limited his freedom of action in the next crisis in 1939, Polish crisis. Did Hitler want to use this as a means of bringing about a war with the West? By no means. He thought the West would give away. That, Sontag has this wonderful quote, that in a war of nerves, Nazi nerves would prove stronger. It was to be just a war of nerves, the threat of war. But British policy had changed. as far as the mass of the British electorate was concerned, mass of the British population, the key event that led to this change was the German seizure of the rump Czechoslovak state, seizure of Prague, German occupation of Prague, in March of 1939. This is what led to this huge shift away from the policy of appeasement to the policy of resistance. Right? The British, to Hitler's surprise, continued to hold out. Each side got, as the crisis developed through the summer of 1939, each side got involved deeper and deeper until neither side could pull back. War breaks out in 1939, not the war that Hitler wanted. He was not happy with the outbreak of the war. He did not know what to do. He had maneuvered to avoid it with all of his strength, going so far as to conclude this pact with Soviet Russia. Why the Nazi-Soviet pact on the eve of the war in August of 39? It was like Hitler calculated the British knew they couldn't do anything to save Poland, but the USSR is right there. The USSR could be brought into the war against Germany, and that would kind of deter Germany. Making this deal with Stalin to basically divide up Poland and to have Soviet Russia remain neutral was a maneuver designed to get the British to cave. It didn't work. In fact, it had the opposite effect. Right? Shows Hitler, his goal was to get the British to accede, to give way in the crisis. Other proofs are, you know, the fact that there was no equivalent of the Schlieffen Plan in September 1939, no rapid invasion of France. Germans had to improvise after the outbreak of the war. That I quoted that remarkable comment that Hitler made to Ribbentrop when he received the news of the British declaration of war. He turns to Ribbentrop and he says, you know, was nun, you know, what do we do now? This was not something the Germans had wanted. And in fact, it triggers a process that over which Hitler no longer has full control. His initiative becomes much narrower than it had been. What happens? The key to understanding the story of the origins of the Second World War as a truly global conflict, a conflict that breaks out in December of 1941, the key to understanding this 1939 to 1941 story is the America factor, what they call the America factor. United States in the interwar period, you know, very leery of European involvement, you know. Wilson had this great vision of collective security, of a profoundly peaceful world. The Europeans, they didn't want to bother it. They sabotaged his plan. We'll let them stew in their own juices. Like these events of the post-1919 period, especially in the 1930s, they showed what a mistake it was for the United States to intervene in the First World War in the first place. All these great hopes that people had of war to end wars, war to make the world safe for democracy, and so on. The war had exactly the opposite effect, so why do it again? You know, Roosevelt took a more power political perspective, but he felt like after September 1939, well, you want to kind of discreetly support the Western powers, but Britain and France are strong enough by themselves to hold their own against Germany in essentially defensive war. That's why the fall of France in May of 1940, you know, came as such a shock and led to such a profound transformation of American policy. Roosevelt now wanted to play a much more active role in supporting Britain. And ultimately, the implication of this was that since American material aid to Britain wouldn't be enough to get the British to hold out and ultimately defeat Hitler, ultimately America would have to come into the war. All this stuff he couldn't say in public, especially given that there was this, he was running for re-election to a third term. The elections were going to be in November of 1940. But that was his thing. And it was clear enough to Hitler which way American policy was moving. Hitler had a certain window of opportunity. He knew where Roosevelt wanted to take the country. He knew that Roosevelt was held back for domestic political reasons. This gave him a certain window of opportunity. He had to move. That whole prospect of an eventual American intervention led to the decision to attack the Soviet Union. You know, at least the timing of that decision was very much influenced by the America factor. And that event, which is the next great important event in the whole story of 39 to 41, came in June of 1941, German invasion of the Soviet Union. Very important because it leads to a quickening of the pace in terms of American involvement. You can see the power of window thinking on all sides. You know, Hitler senses his window of opportunity is closing. That pushes him ahead. But that creates a certain window of opportunity for the Americans. They can't just sit on their hands and allow Hitler to conquer Soviet Russia. If we were able to do so, we'd have a couple of years to harness those resources to the German war machine. And when he did that, Germany would be essentially unconquerable. The threat, long-term threat to American security would be unbearable. So we got to move sooner rather than later. We got to enter the war sooner rather than later. All right. And he tries to provoke a German declaration of war with the undeclared naval war of the second half of 1941. This essentially begins in August of 41. The American Navy is ordered to shoot first at these German ships, German submarines, essentially. But Hitler doesn't buy it. You know, we know this was Roosevelt's strategy because he tells this to Churchill at the Argentia meeting in August. Hitler doesn't allow himself to be provoked because he has his hands full with Russia and he knows what an American intervention would mean. He restrains his admirals. And Roosevelt senses that he needs, you know, another iron in the fire, another way of bringing the United States in the war. Right? Or at least this is, I think, the most plausible interpretation of what happens. He can use the whole business with Japan as a way of bringing America into the war. The key thing here is the decision to impose an oil embargo at the end of July 1941, just barely a month after the German decision to invade the Soviet Union. The oil embargo. Again, it's very important you understand the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo, how it put Japan in a corner, right? Given that the Japanese needed that oil, the Americans were unwilling to negotiate a deal which would allow oil shipments to resume that was acceptable to the Japanese because the Americans were insisting on a total capitulation of Japan on the China issue. Japan was in a corner, faced with this choice between capitulation over China and war with the United States, you know, because the Americans made it clear the Japanese just seized the oil-producing areas in the Indies, that would mean war. Faced with that choice, well, Japan would go to war with America. Right? And this situation with Japan could be used to bring the United States into the European war. The reaction to Pearl Harbor in Washington, very happy. Precisely because they understood that it meant that the United States could come into the European war. Right? Why else would the American policy have toughened so dramatically from what it had been prior to the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union to what it became beginning in July, except for this whole idea that this was a way of bringing the United States into the European war? Was Roosevelt counting on a German declaration of war? No. Because he knew that given what American public opinion was and how they tended to view the Nazis and the Japanese as part of the same evil conspiracy, that the Americans would hold Germany responsible for Pearl Harbor regardless, or for a Japanese attack on the United States, wherever it happened, regardless, and he could bring in the United States into the war. It was a convenience for him, not a necessity, that Hitler declared war. Why would Hitler do it? Well, because he was losing control, but it served his interest to make it seem that he still held the initiative. In reality, he had lost control of a process, to be sure, which he had played a key role in instigating and getting it to move in the first place, but he lost control of it because German resources were such that Germany could not stand up to a war with the United States. The United States is a far more powerful country once it can mobilize its full military potential. Plus, it had certain geographical advantages over Germany in this war. December 1941, that's the end. You know, Hitler's fate really is sealed, and he kind of half knows it. No idea how to beat the United States. So December 1941 marks the end of one story, a story which can only be understood if you take these power political considerations, window considerations, into account. The end of one story, and in fact the beginning of another, the story of the Cold War and international politics after the Second World War. So let me end there. I'll see you in class on Monday for the exam, and then on Wednesday we'll begin with the story of the Cold War. We have a little bit of time. I don't see the
I just
teacher
have, like,
for the next
couple
next
basic time. Questions to clear up some of the confusion.
Let me. Your questions are going to be.